I've spent the last few years, or I've spent the last two decades really, sort of writing from other countries about oftentimes human rights problems in those countries. And I come to it as an American with some sense that, yes, we are in this ongoing multi-century struggle of our own to try to live up to our core aspirations, whether it's equal opportunity, equal rights, a truly free press, and so on. And I am, I think, chastened and made more humble by this period of recognizing just how much work has to be done in this country for us to even say that we're an agent for those values around the world.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 12th, 2020. China Talk is the newest member of the Lawfare Podcast family, and its impresario, Jordan Schneider, does a wide range of interviews related to China's economy and security. The current episode of China Talk, in which he interviews Evan Osnos of The New Yorker, is a particularly interesting conversation about the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre and the relationship between that date and the clearing of Lafayette Square. It's a fascinating conversation that covers everything from the psychological similarities and differences between Donald Trump and Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping to Chinese hip-hop and why it is not catching on internationally. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 12th, Evan Osnos on Tiananmen and Lafayette.
Evan, thanks for coming on China Talk.
My pleasure, Jordan. Thanks for having me.
So I find it unbelievable that it is even remotely possible to have a conversation comparing something happening in the U.S. in 2020 with Tiananmen, but here we are.
Well, you know what's interesting about this, Jordan? It's such an interesting moment. Obviously, this almost bizarre cosmic overlap of the anniversary of June 4th, the massacre of Tiananmen, with the very moment that we're having this national protest movement in the United States. For anybody who is an American China nerd, this is just kind of powerfully evocative. And my initial reaction was, hold on here. Let's be very cautious about making casual analogies, because it can run the risk of actually sort of dishonoring the scale of the tragedy at Tiananmen in 89.
Yeah,
that's actually, sure. You know, we're talking about a huge loss of life in a matter of days in Beijing and elsewhere. And then there are, of course, actually really interesting parallels. And one of them being this idea of a leadership that is fortifying itself against its own people. That, for me, is the part that rises to the surface. You know, anytime you end up in a situation in which a leadership either sort of physically, geographically, or ultimately, those are all reflections of like spiritually and intellectually, they are literally barricading themselves against their own citizenry. And that's what's happening right now in Washington. And that's what happened in Beijing in 89. So even if we can bracket the comparison by saying, let's not get into the business of casually invoking Tiananmen all the time, because it undermines the seriousness of what happened in 89. It is true that there is some really fascinating parallel there, I think.
And how about the sort of executive military branch tensions? You know, of course, famously in Tiananmen, there were leaders of the military as well as troops who were not at all down with the program.
Yeah.
Which is a tension that we've certainly seen play out with, you know, the Secretary of Defense coming out and saying, we don't want to do this and have active military on the ground.
Yeah. And another comparison that's super interesting is that here in Washington, there are National Guard units from around the country. So from Utah, for instance, or elsewhere. And what I found fascinating is that was a feature of the military strategy at Tiananmen, was to get military units from far away from Beijing so that they felt no personal connection to the people in the capital. And oftentimes they regarded the people in the capital as these kinds of, you know, privileged elite kids, spoiled brats, basically, who were coming and rising up and so on. And it's not a stretch to see some similar kind of over the mountains and over the mountains to Utah from the palace here in Washington, bringing people in who don't feel connected to it. There is something eerie about that. I was very struck by that as I looked at those images of the men in uniform at the Lincoln Memorial, which I think for a lot of us kind of galvanized, crystallized this thing, the moment, and thinking to myself, what's going on in that man's mind as he thinks about the people here before him? Because there is that vast divide. I don't want to quite say urban rural, because in some cases it's not really that, but it is definitely power center and province.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, it's really GOP Democrat as much as anything else, where you saw a sort of series of Republican governors like offering up their tribute you know, 500 or 1,000 National Guard members. So not to just rip on Utah.
One of the moments that I was really struck by was, I mean, not only having the mayor of Washington write Black Lives Matter in huge type down the middle of the asphalt so that Trump can see it from his helicopter when he flies away. I mean, that's an amazing moment of political expression playing out. But also the fact that Arlington County, Virginia, and forgive me if I get some of the facts here wrong, but I think this is right. They withdrew their National Guard, or they withdrew their cops. Actually, it was their cops, because they felt like they weren't being used responsibly in Washington. It's an extraordinary sort of exhibit of the nature of American governance, that you have these different levels of the federalist system at war with one another. And if you want to find a positive thing there, and there is something positive, it's that this is all happening, and it's happening in public, and that we're sort of watching as different political leaders are using the power that they have to check one another. And that's better than the alternative, which is having a central executive that is steamrolling over everything without the ability for these other layers to impede it.
Yeah. So Joseph Terigian, who's a Western political scientist, wrote a piece a few years ago doing a sort of retrospective on what we know now about the decision-making that led up to the Tiananmen crackdown. And one of his sort of hypotheses, which I think is fascinating to think about in the context of, you know, June in America 2020, is the idea that, and I'm quoting here, it is possible that Deng understood that the process could be diffused without violence, but feared that such a solution would have created an uncontrolled political space with unforeseen long-term implications. Deng was clearly afraid about protests becoming a regular feature of the political landscape and making the reform and opening process more difficult.
I think, in a way, I have a hard time drawing too close a comparison between Deng and Trump, simply because, for all of Deng's failures, and they were, some of them are profound and historic, he was of a different nature and totally different order of kind of political leadership. He'd done the reading, to be blunt about it. Like, he actually was, coming from a very different biography. I think Trump is basically operating from a fairly thin personal playbook, a combination of kind of adrenal impulses and moments of political self-protection. And Deng, you know, made a catastrophic error at Tiananmen Square, but he was also probably operating with some more theory behind it, even if the theory was wrong.
I think the sort of thinness of his thinking really reflects back to this quote that he gave in 1990 to Playboy, back when Playboy was a place that did journalism. He said that Trump said that, quote, when students poured into Tiananmen Square, the Chinese government almost blew it, but they were vicious. They were horrible, and they put it down with strength. That shows you the power of strength. Our country is right now being perceived as weak, is being spit on by the rest of the world. So, you know, Trump clearly wasn't thinking, oh, this will be good for, you know, Gaga Kaifeng. But I think there's some gut level where he just doesn't want to be shown up sees folks marching in uniform as something that's a show of strength and makes him feel stronger when, you know, we'll get to this. Obviously, this is like shows just how weak he is as a president.
What I found interesting about that quote is, in some ways, Trump has been consistent over the years in his adulation of raw force, And it's interesting, too, because you could take that quote that he gave to Playboy in 1990 and you could say, well, I wonder if Xi Jinping in a private moment would say something like that. And he probably yeah. would. The difference, of course, is that Xi Jinping is cannier about what he says in public. So even Xi Jinping might not praise Tiananmen in quite those terms. So, of course, we know that he would agree with the disposition and what they did. But it begins to help you then understand, why does Trump look at people like Xi Jinping or leaders who have that power of use of force? And why does he admire them so much? It's not, sometimes we wonder, is it simply the scale of China's economy? Is it the kind of gilded glamour of life in Beijing? Is it one party state? What is it? I think on the most basic level, it's the application of force and the potential to use that that is the chief seduction for Donald Trump when it comes to why he likes authoritarianism so much.
So, it's funny you brought that up, because like Xi, when he goes to Davos, which God knows if that's ever going to happen again, but he goes to Davos and he gives a speech, and he, the delivery is like convincing. Right.
You know,
he's not sitting up there like Trump would when he's told to give a speech, which he doesn't maybe 100% believe in. And he's, rolling his eyes and like, skipping every third sentence. But like, there's just a level of game playing, which mm-hmm. he is clearly operating at a higher level than this president. But mm-hmm. it's interesting to think, you said, like, would Trump really rather prefer to be in a different leading mm-hmm. not necessarily a democracy, but a different system. And it's funny to me thinking about this, because in order to rise up a communist apparatchik, you really, like, yes, you need the head start of having your father have a revolutionary credentials or whatnot, but there's also like a lot of games and like interpersonal yeah. dynamics that need to be played. And yeah. If Trump was not elected president, like, there is no way that he would win any bureaucratic power
totally. Struggle. Yeah, no, that's actually, all of us have heard from Chinese friends and counterparts this idea that, the system in which you groom a leader through all of these levels, where they first are, they're the head of the local grain association, then eventually they're the county chair, and then this and this and this, that it does introduce a level of, they acquire almost a physical vocabulary of how you behave in certain settings, how you give deference to the person who is the leader above you. And I actually think what's interesting is, in American politics, there's some elements of that, not always. Obviously, we do have more of a belief in the idea of a transcendent political figure who can kind of, in their first run for office, go into some senior role. But there are bits of political theater that we have in Washington, too. I mean, you spend 5 minutes watching the Senate and you kind of see some of those bits of the ways in which people give deference to one another, and that's partly self-serving, they're sort of making their way up. But then we're living in this period now when there are people who are blowing that up.
So we've done Trump as dung, but let's do Trump as Mao. So mm-hmm. you tweeted a quote from Lin Biao from the great Frank Dittaker quadrilogy.
Yeah,
a historian of modern China. Lin said that, quote, Mao worships himself, has blind faith in himself, adores himself, will take credit for every achievement, but blame others for his failures. So, I mean, there's clearly some difference in the way that the anxieties and insecurities have played out in the minds of Donald Trump and Mao Zedong. But I'm curious for your sort of reflections on the two.
I have a problem, Jordan, which is that I've exhausted my reservoir for Trump psychoanalysis because I got interested in it when he was a candidate and I got obsessed with it. And I wrote a lot about like trying to understand how the hell we'd gotten ourselves into this situation. And that was like a long time ago now. And it feels to me like the tank is empty. I'm sort of kidding, because actually the tank refills itself once a new moment arrives. And this moment right now of the protest movement, which seems to be challenging not just Trump, obviously, but an entire embedded system of injustice, is a moment that revives your focus on what Trumpism represents. So, but to go back to your point, yes, there are delicious points of comparison between Trump and Mao. And it goes to anybody who imagines themselves as a figure of salvation. I mean, that's part of the risk of, like, I have a soft spot for documentaries about cults, And anytime you watch something like that, you are reminded of the elements of kind of the catastrophes of overly charismatic leadership. And I mean, charismatic in the technical sense, not as a normative compliment. But so it always happens that way.
So, you know, the protest movement has been something that's been covered very aggressively within media in China and has now been turned into a sort of political weapon. I'm curious if you could sort of prognosticate about what this protest movement and the government's response is, you know, what impact it has on U.S.-China relations and America's place in the world.
I think this protest movement, which is obviously being watched very closely around the world, is a sign of how the United States is struggling internally to prove that it's living up to the aspirations it expects of itself and other countries. I mean, to be blunt about it, it gets a lot harder to go and tell the Burmese government that you need to do better in protecting the rights of minorities and restricting the arbitrary use of force when we're having a movement in our own country that is demanding those very improvements. And that's good, actually. This is actually a hard one to get right, Jordan, and I am glad we're talking about it because it's really important. Like, I'm going through this process right now thinking to myself, okay, I've spent the last few years, or I've spent the last 2 decades really, sort of, you know, writing from other countries about oftentimes human rights problems in those countries. And I come to it as an American with some sense that, yes, we are in this ongoing multi-century struggle of our own to try to live up to our core aspirations, whether it's, you know, equal opportunity, equal rights, a truly free press, and so on. And I am, I think, chastened and made more humble by this period of recognizing just how much work has to be done in this country for us to even say that we're an agent for those values around the world. That's the honest answer, you know?
Yeah, I think there's sort of two sides to this coin. There's the obvious one that you spoke to with Burma. There's the one talking about sort of mainstream Chinese public opinion. You know, I've had a few conversations with friends. The stuff I've read on social media, it's like, look at how, you know, isn't it great that we don't have to put up with this shit? But there's also from sort of, you know, mainstream Chinese who see any sort of action on the streets as dangerous and scary. And that, of course, is amplified by, you know, every video you see on Douyin, every state media broadcast only showing, you know, people burning Targets and Nike stores. Yep. But I think the point you alluded to, Evan, is really important, is that, like, I think there's, and I imagine this was also sort of the dynamic in 2003 with all the anti-war protests around Bush, is that, like, it's important for the world to know that not everyone's like on board with what's going on in the White House. And, you know, with Trump being such an outsized media personality and so easy to cover around the world, like, it's understandable. But I think just seeing all the protests all the solidarity movements that you've seen in all these capitals in Europe and South America, it makes you hopeful that, like, enough people still believe that America's, like, can be something good.
Yeah, I actually think, you know, there's two ways you can look at it. So there's the superficial reaction to what's going on in the United States. That's what you see sometimes from a kind of triumphalist nationalist Chinese perspective, which is, aha, see, American democracy has always been a fiction and a lie, and better to have suppression and quiet than to have open, sometimes violent protest. And the reaction is no. Like, silence is often a sign of the absence of political movement towards, you know, let's say, bending the arc of justice. I'm going to borrow from, you know, my colleague Joe Lepore at The New Yorker, who has made the really, I think, important, sort of profound point. It's more than a point. It's a theme of a lot of the work she's doing, that oftentimes, like, protest is painful and is also the sign that you're moving in the direction of something better. And one of the things that we see in China is that the inability to have that protest, it's not only dangerous for the government to not really understand how where and what kind of dissatisfaction there is, it's also a sign that it's not moving in the direction of greater fulfillment of those kinds of aspirations. So, you know, and then, so that's part of it. And then there's the other side of it, which is like, so yeah, American democracy as a brand is being harmed over the course of these few years by the election of Donald Trump, the, you know, let's call it shorthanded, by the violence he has done to America's governance. And then at the same time, what we're witnessing right now, what the world is witnessing, is that Americans actually believe enough in these concepts to go into the streets about them and to risk themselves and their personal interests in order to try to push the country into a better place. So that's good.
Yeah. So, you know, we've been talking a fair amount about the present and the current sort of state of U.S.-China relations post coronavirus, which we've talked a lot about on the show, is likely at a, is perhaps, you know, some folks have said it, I guess you've said in your piece, is at an all-time low since probably since Nixon. But I think still important to sort of look back and reflect on to what extent this was all predestined.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's your take? What are the contingencies worth thinking about that could have sort of changed the relationship over the past, you know, 20, I guess, 30 years?
Yeah. Well, so here, but here's an interesting point. Why would we say Nixon in 72 versus Carter in 79, right? That's when relations were actually normalized. And so the reason why I think there's a distinction that's meaningful is that when you say that this is the worst point in U.S.-China relations since 79, what you're implying is that in the years before the formal normalization of relations, that things were more tense than they are now, when actually the crucial ingredient was there in the 72 to 79 period, which is a fundamental belief in a shared notion of the direction. I mean, even if they were wary of each other, they believed that they were heading towards a common destination, which was trying to bring these two huge powers, you know, China's case, soon to be a huge power, into alignment with each other. And that's the thing that is missing today, is that we actually have, and that gets to your point about predestination here, that to some degree, whether or not Trump was president and whether or not he introduced his kind of grab bag of China tactics, not quite even strategy, that you had a case where the two powers had lost the much more important ingredient, which is a shared notion of what the future looks like to some degree. I'm not pretending that China ever imagined they were going to become a democracy. I think that's a straw man. I think what I'm saying is that they at least imagined, both sides, that there was some companionable way for these two to get along with each other. And that had begun to erode over the course of the last few years, even before Trump. It's gotten much, much stronger under Trump, you know, that sense of confrontation, but it was happening. I think, you know, we often ask the question, oh, okay, how much of this would have happened if Trump hadn't come to power? It's an interesting question, which is how much of this would have happened if Xi Jinping hadn't come to power? That's actually a much harder one to answer, because how much is Xi Jinping a product of this lower trust of the United States, this higher tolerance for confrontation, all those kinds of questions? I don't know. I mean, I'd be curious what you think.
I mean, Li Keqiang just seems like much less of an asshole. He's like not a son of a bitch. And like him as like less of a son of a bitch, like that's the part that gets put forward, right? Because he's in this he's in this role where he's doing, you know, economic policy, and he's like liberalizing the food stalls and talking about poverty all the time. And, you know, clearly these are things that he cares about, right? But you know, when you're the top dog, you also have to deal with the US, with the trade war, with Donald Trump. And like, you know, it's not inconceivable that he would sort of draw the same conclusions if the place that he was in was different from the place he is now. So you know, I mean, that's hypothetical number one. Like Bo Xilai, I mean, who the fuck knows what would have happened with him running the show.
I do think that in a way, the, you know, the Xi Jinping that we all began to see in 2013, 2014, when, let's remember, Donald Trump was still hosting The Apprentice. But that person is very much the person that we see now. So Xi Jinping arrived in office with a vision for what he wanted to do. And I think, you know, the degree to which that's gotten, you know, heightened or accelerated because of Trump is a separate question. But I think I really do. I'm of the view that like she represented a fundamental break. That might be overstating it, but that she did represent a new direction for the leadership. And I have this debate, like an ongoing debate with friends who follow China about how much was all of this, was the train already in motion? And sure, it's true. Like under Hu Jintao, you did see a tightening up. There's just no question that post 2008, you saw this trend towards tightening up, but degree matters and it entered a whole new phase. And then one last thing I'll mention on that subject of like leadership and why it matters is that part of the reason why it matters that Xi Jinping is the leader of the party is that he has an effect on all of the people underneath him who, you know, might behave in one way or another, but given the fact that he's the leadership, they take the maximalist authoritarian position. And there's something similar with Trump. You know, you see people who might operate on a bandwidth spectrum of different behaviors, but because he is the boss and kind of validates these things, then they end up taking that maximalist position. So that's the effect over time.
So I've asked this to a few guests now, but we'll throw it to you as well. Is there any way this improves with Xi still in power?
I can see it improving. Yeah, actually. I can't give you a roadmap for how that happens. But I think that one thing that's worth keeping in our minds about it is that Xi is not delusional about China's ability to win a real war with the United States. I think that's worth keeping in mind. Like he might have an overinflated sense of how China would handle a specific point of conflict. Like he might be reckless about his use of particularly assets at sea, but I don't think he believes that China would emerge stronger from a real conflict with the United States. Now, I know that's kind of going a little far down the runway in terms of your question, but like, that is an outer bound on what I think they're willing to do.
I mean, that's a tricky framing, Evan, because like all it takes is one sort of miscalculation, right?
Yeah.
She thinks, all right, like Meguo Luoma, like
right.
they don't, you know,
right.
let's play with Taiwan and see what happens. And then all of a sudden, a lot of things get out of his control. And regardless that he has this prior that like American carriers aren't as shitty as some of his admirals think they are, you still end up in a really, really scary situation because he has this other prior, which is that Taiwan's defenses aren't all there. You know,
yeah.
He has either the prior that Taiwan's defenses aren't all they're cracked up to me, or like net, this is still a positive for my domestic political position, for like the glory of China.
You know, you kind of persuaded me. And so you did, I have to say, set out a hard task, which is, you know, in the midst of a global pandemic with Trump as president and the US-China at their worst point in the history of the relationship, is there any reason, is there any conceivable course for optimism? And I tried, and I think I kind of failed.
You know what also really bummed me out, and this is less serious than a war in Taiwan, but you know, as listeners know, I spent a fair amount of time following Chinese hip-hop. And what I found really remarkable over the past few weeks is the extent to which the like global K-pop fandom has really gotten behind Black Lives Matter. And
you know,
BTS fans from South Korea and Brazil and Japan and even within China have like donated, I think, over $1 million to various, you know, bail funds and police reform causes. The hip-hop artists in China who have made their livings off of black culture and you know, oftentimes say, hey, like, look at us, we, you know, we respect our elders, and like, if you don't listen to like Big Pun, then you're not real hip-hop and whatever. The silence I've seen from them is just so depressing. And you try to look at things like cultural connections and the fact that so many Chinese love basketball and you know, listen to American music and whatnot as sort of hope for the future. But if even the folks that their lives are built off of black culture in America, like, think either that it's too dangerous for them to say Black Lives Matter on their domestic Weibos, or it just doesn't resonate to them as something that's important, it's just so disheartening. And
that's a really important insight, actually. Yeah, you're onto something there. I mean, I think it's a, probably a measure of all of those things. I mean, a degree of, there's a level of self-censorship. There's probably also a level that they frankly just feel they are actually, they don't feel connected to that American experience. And that's telling of itself.
It was interesting because a fair amount of them either like posted very pro-government things during Hong Kong. And that is something I can not forgive, but understand given the sort of media environment they've grown up in and given the pressure that they're facing. Like, you know, when every other Chinese celebrity on Weibo is saying, go dial like Hong Kong police. And if you're not the one saying that, that puts you in a very difficult situation. But this is like, I feel like there would be more room to run as someone who just wanted to make a statement or, you know, give $1,000 or whatever. And the fact that didn't happen is really, really, really upsetting.
I mean, I think it's probably, you know, it's a reflection of how the civil rights movement and the Black freedom struggle has been described in Chinese education. It's not there, you know, it's never like drawn as something with relevance for Chinese people today. That's one thing. And then, you know, what I think is something also, this reminds me of what I've always found to be a persistently interesting question, which is why K-pop is so successful around the world and Chinese pop culture is not. And that's, as you know, is a source of incredible frustration to certainly China's political leadership, but also to some degree, Chinese artists who will often be frustrated by that. And depending on their level of independence and awareness, they will either recognize and blame the censorship system for that, or they will have other explanations. But I think part of the, you know, this just shows you that in some ways the K-pop world has been more, is more awake to these kinds of, you know, these global phenomena than the Chinese hip hop world is. And that's an interesting point, actually, because to the outside observer, they might, you know, you might gloss over the distinctions.
So speaking of sort of like international cultural capital, in this January piece you wrote about U.S.-China relations, you had the pleasure of speaking to none other than Judd Apatow, which I'm sure was a first on the U.S.-China beat for someone like yourself, Evan. So the point was that, you know, and I think this is like a truth pretty long established now, that major Hollywood studios are scared of having things in scripts, of casting particular actors that would upset the mainland market. But you know, it just sort of occurred to me that there's one giant studio pool of money which has zero China exposure, which is, of course, Netflix. So, and I think they've probably gotten the message at this point. You know, the Mark Zuckerberg running in China, like hopeful that one day we'll be let in moment, I think is probably gone forever for the Netflix team. So, you know, say you decide that running around and talking to protesters is just not what you want to do for the next 10 years, Evan. If you wanted to pitch a docudrama, a scripted show, delving into Chinese society or Chinese politics to the execs up at Netflix, what topics do you think deserve their own dance review?
I've always thought that the best description of Washington politics, having moved here, is not House of Cards. It's Veep. And Veep captures all of the sort of vanities and the small ways in which people make bad decisions all the time. And one of the things that we don't get when we talk about Chinese politics is some of that. I think that would be amazing. I mean, I would love to see a show about, you know, that. I mean, we sometimes talk about death of Stalin as such an interesting window into the nature of authoritarian governments and why people do the things they do. And I've often, you know, death of Stalin is an appropriate reference for understanding Trump world these days too, because all of that sort of the myth making and the creating of worlds around him and so on. I would love to see something funny about Chinese politics. We don't see that very often. I think it's worth also pointing out here, you know, in spirit of our conversation, we're talking about some really serious stuff and we're talking about grave stuff and people's lives are on the line. So I don't want people to think that when we can laugh about it, that we're making jokes about it. It's sort of not that. It's like we're finding the mordant moments of light and levity within a subject that we've thought a lot about and we care about, you know? And so the fact that Veep is like an amazing portrait of Washington is not to, to make light of the seriousness of what happens in Washington, but in fact is a pretty powerful insight into the role of individual persona and personality when it comes to these huge decisions that impact lots of people. I find that really revealing.
I'm sold. I'll invest. the maybe $4 we're going to make from recording this show. So Evan, any sort of broader reflections to sum up the differences you've had just reporting on the U.S. over the past 6 years versus your stint on the mainland?
Yeah, in the sense I spent a long time living overseas and reporting on political culture in other places. You know, lived in Egypt and reported a lot in Iraq and lived in China, obviously, and then did a lot around those regions. And in some ways, coming back to the United States has been a process of coming to understand and trying to answer the question for myself of how we became so alienated from the values that we try to project around the world. And I actually feel almost like a personal responsibility to go back and begin to answer that question. Like, how did we actually lose our ability to give people social mobility, the kind that we at least purport to protect? And how did we lose sight of the ability to protect our most vulnerable people? Those issues feel not just relevant on a domestic basis, but also for how the rest of the world thinks about the United States. And I feel like I've got a hand in that process, and that kind of feels like something I need to do.
Well, as one of the few journalists who still has a job and a platform with which to explore those questions, I am frankly glad that you are one of those trying to work this all out for us.
Well, Evan, having me today.
Thank you so much on China Talk. This was fascinating.
This was a lot of fun. Thanks, Jordan.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, and today it is produced in cooperation with China Talk, which, as I said before, is the newest member of the Lawfare podcast family. It has, 90 episodes in its archives, including great interviews with the likes of Jake Sullivan, Peter Hessler, and Bill Bishop. So you'll want to search China Talk on your favorite podcast app and subscribe to it. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineer is Zachary Frank of the Goat Rodeo Firm. Our music is, of course, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And of course, you can get your merch at thelawfarestore.com. And as always, thanks for listening.